Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Greetings, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for tuning in. Discovery Institute Press's 2018 book, Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design, by European bioscientist Matti Laisola and Jonathan Witt, recently pulled in its 100th Amazon review, with the great majority of them being enthusiastic 5-star reviews. To celebrate, I'm pleased to bring you a new reading from the work, the opening pages of Chapter 11. In case you haven't come across this book yet, it's the entertaining story of the sparks that fly when one scientist decides to follow the evidence where it leads. It all started when a student loaned the Finnish scientist Laisola a book criticizing evolutionary theory. Determined to defend evolution, Laisola found his efforts raised more questions than answers. He soon morphed into a full-on Darwin skeptic, even as he was on his way to becoming a leading bioengineer. Heretic is the story of Laisola's adventures making waves, and many friends and enemies, at major research labs and universities across Europe. Along the way, it draws on Laisola's expertise in molecular biology to show how the evidence points more strongly than ever to a designing intelligence at the heart of life. I'm reading today from Chapter 11, titled The Chasm Widens. In 1847, a Hungarian medical doctor, Ignaz Semmelweis, noticed that many women died after childbirth of childbed fever. After investigating the situation more closely, he started to suspect that this was somehow connected to doctors who came directly from autopsy to examine the women after birth. Semmelweis suspected that the doctors brought something on their hands that caused the childbed fever. His suspicions intensified when one of his colleagues got similar symptoms after cutting his finger during an autopsy. After he ordered doctors to wash their hands with chlorine water, the patient death rate plummeted. In spite of this clear evidence that Semmelweis was onto something, his colleagues and the larger scientific community did not take him seriously. He was humiliated, and growing increasingly bitter and erratic, was lured by a colleague into an insane asylum. When he tried to leave, he was beaten so severely by the guards that he died a few days afterward. Years later, Semmelweis was vindicated when the role of bacteria in disease became clear. The term the Semmelweis reflex was coined in honor of him and as a warning to scientists. It refers to the rejection of new knowledge because it contradicts entrenched norms, beliefs, and paradigms. The history of science shows that the Semmelweis reflex is all too common among scientists. When the evidence turns against a scientific paradigm, it often dies only very slowly and painfully, be it the geocentric cosmology, the more recent static universe cosmology, humoralism, unmoving continents, phlogiston, or neo-Darwinism. The parallels between the now defunct theory of phlogiston and neo-Darwinism are particularly illuminating. Of phlogiston, Antoine Lavoisier, the father of modern chemistry, offered this observation. Chemists have made phlogiston a vague principle, which is not strictly defined, and which consequently fits all the explanations demanded of it. Sometimes it has weight, sometimes it has not. Sometimes it is free fire, sometimes it is fire combined with an earth. Sometimes it passes through the pores of vessels, sometimes they are impenetrable to it. It explains at once transparency and opacity, color and the absence of colors. It is a veritable Proteus that changes its form every instant. Phlogiston was foundational to chemistry education, although the problems associated with it were observed a century and a half before it even started to waver. The theory held that a mysterious substance called phlogiston was released from a burning substance, but already in 1630 James Ray wondered why the oxide of tin was heavier than the starting material, if burning had released phlogiston. But not to worry, the supporters of phlogiston theory reasoned that in some cases phlogiston could have a negative weight. The story of phlogiston shows how an established paradigm may persist in the face of contrary evidence because its supporters patch it up ad nauseam instead of following the evidence. The Darwinian theory of evolution is the phlogiston of our day, festooned with a myriad and growing number of patches. Evolution is slow and gradual, except when it's fast. It is dynamic and creates huge changes over time, except when it keeps everything the same for millions of years. It explains both extreme complexity and elegant simplicity. It tells us how birds learned to fly, and how some lost that ability. Evolution made cheetahs fast and turtles slow. Some creatures it made big and others small, some gloriously beautiful and some boringly grey. It forced fish to walk and walking animals to return to the sea. It diverges except when it converges. It produces exquisitely fine-tuned designs except when it produces junk. Evolution is random and without direction except when it moves towards a target. Life under evolution is a cruel battlefield, except when it demonstrates altruism. Evolution explains virtues and vice, love and hate, religion and atheism, and it does all this with a growing number of ancillary hypotheses. Modern evolutionary theory is the Rube Goldberg of theoretical constructs. And what is the result of all this speculative ingenuity? Like the defunct theory of phlogiston, it explains everything without explaining anything well. Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe urge us to be cautious of a theory that needs ever more ancillary hypotheses when faced with new facts. Our interpretation is, and this is quote, "Be suspicious of a theory if more and more hypotheses are needed to support it as new facts become available, or as new considerations are brought to bear. This interpretation leaves Darwinism in a poor way, for this is exactly what has happened to Darwin's theory." Unquote. The central problems of the theory of evolution have been known from the beginning. With growing scientific knowledge, the problems have only increased. Darwinism turned to neo-Darwinism, and now we are in a post-neo-Darwinian era, even as biologists wedded to a designer-free theory offer up various new and ancillary hypotheses to save the idea of blind evolution. In search of a solution, Richard Goldschmidt subscribed to an old idea called saltation, evolution by jumps. Saltation would explain why there are no links, living or fossilized, between basic animal groups. But Goldschmidt was unable to offer an explanation for how new forms could emerge so quickly. His view was knocked down as biologically impossible. In 1972, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge noted the fossil record's persistent pattern of abrupt appearance of novel biological forms, followed by long periods of stasis. They proclaimed neo-Darwinism dead, and suggested punctuated equilibrium, or punk-eek, to replace it. But biologists rejected the idea for lacking a credible mechanism for generating biological change so quickly, and later Gould adjusted his theory toward neo-Darwinism. But efforts to find an alternative to neo-Darwinism persisted. Of particular note, in summer 2008, 16 researchers representing evolutionary biology, paleontology, and philosophy met at the Konrad Lorenz Institute in Altenburg, Austria. The media called the group the Altenburg 16. The members of the group had different and even contradictory views, but all agreed that the modern evolutionary synthesis was in trouble, and that new hypotheses were needed to explain the origin of biological form. Graham Budd, one of the participants, said, "When the public thinks about evolution, they think about the origin of wings and the invasion of the land. But these are things that evolutionary theory has told us little about." The Altenburg 16's effort to break neo-Darwinism's stranglehold on origins biology is a breath of fresh air. The development of science thrives on open competition among different models. Without a willingness to consider an alternative model, a wrong assumption in a dominant model may persist in the face of mounting experimental evidence, since the proponents of the model will either attribute the experimental results to error or add an ancillary patch to explain away the results. A recent example is the static eternal model of the universe. Albert Einstein was so wedded to it that he built a fudge factor into his equations after he realized that his general theory of relativity appeared to undermine it. The fudge factor helped explain away the unwelcome implication. But while reluctant, Einstein and some other influential physicists and astronomers were willing to consider a competing model soon propounded by astronomer Edwin Hubble, according to which the universe had a beginning and was expanding. This, in combination with mounting experimental evidence in favor of this new model, eventually doomed the static eternal universe model. As this example illustrates, a new model that better explains the data is typically needed before scientists will, in mass, abandon the once dominant paradigm. If all scientists were strictly rational and unbiased, a competing theory wouldn't be necessary to doom an old paradigm. But scientists are human after all, a fact well attested by both biology and the history of science. A worldview out of every window. Scientists may seem a proud lot, but even the proudest of scientists needs a good dose of humility if he is to be guided by the evidence rather than by personal biases. One way to cultivate this attitude of humble flexibility before the evidence is to recognize that every scientific model that touches on origins automatically also has worldview implications. In this respect, naturalism is compared to theism. Supporters of intelligent design are often accused of mixing a worldview, theism, with science. But a similar charge could be applied to those touting origins theories consonant with atheism. For example, the unprovable idea known as the multiverse has been offered to explain away the curious fact that the laws and constants of physics and chemistry appear fine-tuned to allow for stars, planets, and with them, life somewhere in the universe. On the multiverse theory, there are innumerable other universes, and ours is just one of the lucky ones with the right parameters for life, one of the minority of universes that won the proverbial lottery. The multiverse model, its adherents insist, removes the need to invoke a designer, a fine-tuner, to explain fine-tuning. But notice that this means the theory has clear worldview implications, so the multiverse theory should not be allowed, right? Or is it only scientific theories with theistic implications that are not allowed? The same issue arises with the origin of life question. Was the first microscopic life on Earth the result of blind forces and luck, or was intelligent design involved? Either hypothesis has worldview implications. But for the scientist, the relevant question should be, which explanation is best supported by reason and physical evidence? That was a reading from the book Heretic by Matti Laisola and Jonathan Witt. Find the book on Amazon by searching Heretic, One Scientist's Journey. And if you've already read and enjoyed the book, please leave a quick review on Amazon. Every little bit helps to spread the word that the evidence for intelligent design is growing. I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Join me again very soon. And thanks again for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.